2. Let's see if it works there. Oh, beautiful. It's coming through the monitor circuit in delay, and there we go. All right, so that works too. Wonderful.
It's supported by an expert subcommittee of international lawyers. In Norway, interestingly, most of the legal and policy thinking in relation to Aboriginal issues is coming from international law. And this is something that certainly the Canadian Department of Justice finds intriguing. There will be 3 reports of this committee. The first one is out. The first one proposes that there be a national Aboriginal parliament, a Sami parliament, that has a direct link with the national general parliament. There's a controversy because in the first report, the powers proposed for this parliament are merely advisory, although the national parliament is required to debate and discuss their annual proposals. However, the second report will study in more detail the powers for such a parliament, and there's pressure certainly within the Aboriginal community for significant powers. The report also proposes an amendment to the Norwegian Constitution, which would say that the Norwegian state has an obligation to provide for the basis of continuing Sami culture. And culture in the report, perhaps one of the most interesting features of the report, culture is judged to include material resources, natural resources, traditional lands, the traditional homeland of the people. So the question is somewhat significant. The report also concludes that Norway, because it contains a large number of the Sami, has a very special responsibility before world opinion and the world through international organizations to secure the collective future of the people. And certainly I think those of us working in Canada would be happy if the Canadian government wrote reports with statements like that about the Inuit and Dene homelands. The report also proposes that the national parliament have a full review of Sami policy in the life of every parliament, which in Norway is 4 years, and review the guidelines for policy and develop new ones and also judge the way things are working. There's also...
So this may come up as an issue in the years to come as to whether these bases should be allowed to still be there. At this point, the American military presence is considered as the Danish state's major contribution to the NATO, and they don't pay for it. The Americans do not pay for the bases in Greenland. I think I have run through some of the issues which are characterizing the Greenlandic Home Rule, and I'll therefore just conclude with the third issue that I mentioned, some of the proposals that maybe could be of some interest to you while revising the annexa. The first thing that seems important to me is that when you speak of self-determination to native populations, then I think that legislative power rather than private ownership is what is important. Now this means that I do not doubt the fact that ownership to land in Alaska and Canada has a very great significance and very great importance for the native populations, but I'm only saying that you must see to the fact that you achieve some sort of legislative power, also political powers also, and fill this in the formula that you strive for when you go for your self-determination. I think that legislative power is a very fundamental part of the concept of self-determination, and don't forget it. Having said this, I also think that it is important to do some thoughts about how you organize the contribution of political powers in the self-determination. Now, David Case came up with his proposal saying that the villages should be the ones who decide on local matters, and I certainly agree with him in doing so, but I also would like to iterate that you need also to have some central body on top of the village home rule arrangements that David came up with, some sort of central organization who carries and who's able to fight for at the global level, at the general level, to fight for the achievement of further political rights. So you have to build some sort of a construction on top of the home rule, the village home rule level. Otherwise, I think it would be much too easy to be played around with if there is no central authority which is able to carry the general interests of the native population. So my advice or my proposal would be to try and secure home rule at the local level, but also see to the fact that you create some sort of a body who carries the general interests of the native population. This could be done regionally or it could be done statewide. I don't know. You have to decide on that. And I think the reason that this is important is also that you thereby make it possible to perform and to improve a general planning of the development of your society. Now, I mentioned going through the Greenlandic Home Rule that the major task in these years is to rearrange the industrial policy. Formerly, industrial activities were carried out by the Royal Green and Trade Department, which in Canadian terms would correspond to the Hudson's Bay Company. The Royal Green and Trade Department was established 200 years ago and has...
Commonwealth in Australia, which is the federal government, has promised federal land rights legislation which would override any of the state legislation, hasn't produced it yet, and it's a very contentious political issue in Australia. They've laid out the principles that would inform such legislation, and those principles basically flow from the Northern Territories legislation that's in place, and they certainly limit the notion to proprietary rights, basically. They don't accommodate any notion of political rights or any notion of governmental powers. The one area, I want to come back to that in a minute, but the one area where there is a move away from a simple proprietary notion is in the definition of traditional ownership in the Northern Territories legislation. A traditional owner in that legislation is defined, and I'll quote here, as a local descent group of Aboriginals who have common spiritual affiliations to a site on the land, being affiliations that place the group under a primary spiritual responsibility for that site and for that land, and are entitled by Aboriginal tradition to forage as of right over that land. Now, what that does is extend a notion of material interests to include a broad sense of spiritual interests and spiritual attachment. And in the light of that, and sort of true to that notion, the federal government, though it hasn't passed comprehensive land rights legislation, has passed an interim bill this last spring, what they call a heritage bill, providing considerable protection for sacred sites, which are in some ways the locus, the points of reference, the points of sort of mapping reference for the broad areas that constitute Aboriginal land under the land rights settlements. Now, all of this, as I've mentioned, has the fundamental limitation that it deals not at all with political authorities and with governmental responsibilities. But at the same time that this movement towards legislating land rights and confirming them through land courts has been going on, there have been a couple of other things going on which deal more directly with the issues of governmental authority. And one is the development of a powerful rhetoric asserting Aboriginal sovereignty over Australia, period. And the language of that assertion is simple. It's pay the rent. And it's directed to the white tenants, to the settlers who came after 1788 and who took over land, who dispossessed the Aborigines, who aren't about to admit that the possession is no longer theirs, and are saying that they're quite happy to sit down and negotiate an appropriate rental. It's a notion which is not welcome to the Commonwealth government and to the tenants, but it's one that isn't about to go away, and it's one that is providing energy for the move to broaden the notion of Aboriginal rights through that legislation. It's also providing the Aborigines with some sense of what they're doing when they make certain kinds of accommodations, that they're securing some land and that the deals that they're entering into are land deals, but they're maintaining their prerogative to talk about the questions of sovereignty at a more auspicious time. So they've tried carefully to enter into the discussions about land rights as portrayed within the legislation in a way that will keep intact the notion of sovereignty. They're also moving in a different way, in a way similar to the kind of move that was described yesterday, acting as though they had sovereign rights, acting as governments. What they're doing is, all over Australia, moving back from the settlements out to the country. The movement is called various things, the outstation movement or the move to settle down country, but it's happening from the central deserts up to North Queensland, the tropical area, down to the south, and Aboriginal groups who over the years have been moved in or have moved themselves in to settlements close to town or to settlements where several tribes have been brought together for administrative purposes, are going back to land and acting in every way as though it were their land, as indeed it is. They're refusing to accept that land as anything other than theirs, and they're defying the anxiety and the opposition of many of the state and Commonwealth authorities that are saying you can't do that, folks, and it won't work, and that's not on, and so forth. They're just moving back, and that's having a powerful effect on people's thinking about the notion of Aboriginal sovereignty. The other thing that's happening, and it's part of this, is that out of the communities there are coming some very powerful local organizations. The most interesting and the most striking of which in many ways is the Aboriginal Medical Service, the Aboriginal Health Services, which are community-based, community-run, which are the product initially of urban Aborigines in Redfern, a suburb of Sydney, and in Fitzroy, a suburb of Melbourne, and which have federated together in a group called the National Aboriginal and Islander Health Organization. The communities themselves, the local Aboriginal medical services are service organizations. They provide a range of medical services from the technical to the more holistic. They rely on Aboriginal people as much as possible and hire others, doctors, technicians, and so forth, where necessary. They provide a broad range of social services within those communities. They act as a focus for what are essentially assertions of Aboriginal sovereignty. And drawing from that local energy, the National Aboriginal and Islander Health Organization has been one of the key proponents of land rights, using the powerful argument that ill health, and that the ill health that's epidemic among Aboriginal people is a product of dispossession and dislocation. And the only way to good health is to provide the stability and security that broadly based land rights will provide. And that it would include in due course, as part of the notion, the power to govern the land and to control those communities. As an indication of the interconnectedness, that outstation movement, that movement that I described a minute ago, is not only
all these positions are filled by just 10 people. Now the question is, we can't say that this is not what those people want. In every case, you go out to the villages and you see that they are admirably taking care of a lot of these programs, and you see the city mayor and his staff and everybody else working so hard, and they're very proud of their work, and they're doing a fantastic job in interfacing with a very sophisticated number of state and federal programs. And and you have to see that with services come these obligations. And I hear a lot of people talking as if in a never-never land where they think they can get services or more control without more responsibility and more demands and more levels of bureaucracy and burdens on their own time. And there's hardly any way in which you can get that more control. And so the real issue, you know, whether you're going to go the state route and upgrade and refine your state systems, or whether you want to go the federal route or using native federal law, the whole issue is, do you need more government or do you need less government? If you see the multinationals coming up your road, you're probably going to need a lot more government right away. You're going to have to assemble a whole army of riders, technicians, attorneys, doctors, nurses, filmmakers, planners, engineers. And the North Slope Borough's coastal management plan was just approved. It's a document that took 9 years to formulate. Over $5 million they put into it. Hundreds of meetings up and down the coast, in every area of Alaska, in Washington, constant meetings with engineers from industry, from state and federal agencies. It's a fantastic production. Mainly, they saw that if you're going to regulate people, you have to get the consent of the regulatees. It's just like running a prison. You can't run a prison unless you gain a certain amount of consent from the prisoners. And you're setting up your regulations. So if you're going to set up a system of regulation, you know, governing these enormous multi national industries. These are people like British Petroleum, who are the world's best colonizers in the world and really are very slick. The way they can, I've seen them move into communities, organize rump governments in order to subvert local leadership and things like this. You're going to have to get your best guns, and you're going to have to be able to tax those people to help you pay for what you need to deal with them, to get them to sit down and develop fora, you know, forums for negotiating resource conflicts before they arise. And, you know, you need a lot more than just, you know, the resources of villages. And this is why I say, as a lot of people have said, you know, don't overlook regional governments in taking care of, you know, taking care of resource issues. And I think it's really important to look at resource development. There's going to be so much more resource development in these next 10 years like you've never seen in Alaska. Now, I see the reports that come from industry and the plans they have for Alaska. There's no area of Alaska that will be left untouched because of resources available. Even around here, you go from here to Kenai, you don't think there's much oil involved. But all over you see capped oil wells. The oil companies are already here. They've got their land. They've discovered their oil. They've capped it over, and they say there's nothing here. But it's just not marketable yet. It will be someday. They'll want to go back and exploit those industries. And considering the tremendous resources, you're going to have tremendous amounts of mining and coal and so many other things. And I think every native government, whether it's an IRA or a municipal government, has to prepare for those eventualities and has to be able to organize with other municipalities and regional ways to deal with those things. I would like to just conclude by saying that I think, you know, we are at a watershed, and I think we should go back and put ourselves in the situation that the framers of the Constitution, they were faced not with a blank tablet, but they had to deal with institutions that had been set up over the 90 years of American administration of Alaska, and they realized that they just couldn't do away with all of these institutions. There were already towns set up and public utility districts and school districts mainly. And they were very concerned about getting their boroughs going. And so they had to reconcile their ideas of boroughs with these existing institutions. And I think this is what we have today. We've got a new idea here. We have the idea of native government coming along. And I think one of your biggest assets is to take a good assessment at two things. First of all, looking at existing municipal structures and governmental structures that are being well used by rural people and native people today. Looking at the lessons of those and incorporating them into your new systems. And secondly, to look for two things: how you can get the most possible return for your money, how you can get the most possible strength with the least amount of additional government impositions on the people. And I think if there's one thing this commission can do is to offer guidelines for local governments in evaluating problems. Guidelines for local governments in choosing which forms of governments they want. That'll give them the most possible return for their effort. And I want to just conclude with this quote from the Morehouse, McBeath, and Lee's latest book on local government in Alaska. It says, local and regional organizations provide services and representation that are strongly entrenched. They take full advantage of various sources of authority and funding in the U.S. federal system.
In force, it's called a seditiously liable statute, where a state government or a group of antagonist white people have maligned the natives. that the federal government has a responsibility to go shut them up. And so the state area, so these land grants that came from Congress are not without price. That state of Alaska can lose some of this. So it did not receive because it is sovereign. It received them as a mere gift. It did not have them before, did not have anything before. And so the rights that the state of Alaska has, although in our Constitution, are really nice and there is room for creativity, but we live in the world of human frailty. Human frailty is that the Anglo-Saxon community has not seen in its best interest that the native may be a way to get even with Uncle Sam. He has not utilized this vessel who has sovereign immunity and who can bring gifts and gains to the state that it could not nowhere ever achieve. So I think that the dumbness and the stupidity of the racist is another area of a peculiar study that the mental health community and the well-being covered by the Constitution covers. So those that are mentally deprived of the rights of the Alaska Natives, we may need to have an Inupiaq interpreter for them. And just like we need to interpret the state constitution. And so these guys, I have spent in my lifetime in securing and maintaining these rights in the neighborhood of $15 million for our own protection. And I would like to make another point that the condition of statehood and its boundaries cannot be resolved by the state. Maybe that this race problem that we have in Alaska could be best handled by the esteemed local boundary commission, who is already charged with governmental capacity. And the boundary between the state and the local and the local IRA could be resolved and certified and to be taken to the special master of the
federal Indian law or federal trusteeship. Go ahead and ask for try to get legislation for exactly what you want. If you want immunity from taxation, have that legislated. I would suggest that's probably just as practical a solution as putting the land in trust, another way of getting tax immunity. If you want other kinds of protections, legislate them specifically rather than relying on the usual conventional concepts of Indian law. And in that regard, I can't end without suggesting that I think the notion and the concept of trusteeship ought to be very carefully examined, because I feel that it's being used to describe many, many things, and it may mean things that are not intended. Federal trusteeship, the trust relationship, means at least these things: the obligation of the federal government to provide programs. Well, unfortunately, that's not really enforceable against Congress. Sometimes people mean trusteeship, or they say trusteeship, when they mean that they want the land held in trust so that it won't be taxed. Well, if that's what you want, you can have that done through specific legislation. In fact, the way it's done in ANCSA, now they legislate specifically that certain of the lands can't be taxed. Sometimes trusteeship is used when people simply want to prevent the land from being alienated or lost. Well, that can be done specifically through legislation as well. Also, sometimes people mean they want trusteeship because they want the Interior Department to help manage the land, or they want the federal government to help them. They want Justice Department lawyers to help protect the land. Well, that's okay, but you could do that directly too if you want to. Sometimes they want jurisdiction, they want trusteeship because they want governmental jurisdiction over the land, because they want to have native governmental control over the land to govern their affairs there. But that also can be done directly without necessarily taking the whole thing, getting the whole hog of trusteeship. The reason I say this is that trusteeship carries with it a tremendous power that one places in the hands of the federal government. The trust relationship, I feel, often implies disadvantages for the native people and native governments, and puts power in the hands of the federal government that can be a problem. It isn't always a problem, and some people may feel it's their best shot, but I thought I would offer that since it's been discussed. That, I think, concludes my remarks, except that I've had a strong sense that one thing that was mentioned by, a number of speakers, but I think that because Native people are able to assert and exercise inherent rights that the whole world perceives to be natural and just rights, that you have the power and the ability to assert rights even though they may not be technically, legally protectable. And so those kinds of rights have a particular kind of vitality that survive legal problems, that survive legal losses. But the one thing that they don't survive is you're voluntarily giving them up. And so one thing I'd like to conclude by saying that the law ain't everything. Don't let the law bother you overmuch. What's more important is that you hang on to and you assert the rights that are naturally yours, and I think you'll be all right. The law will catch up with you. Thank you. I'm sorry go on so long.
Browning and Sheldon and Reed, and then I think we'll have to adjourn. Yeah, Browning Pipestem.
I'll try to be brief because I'd like to get a more definitive statement, I guess, as to the, you know, I get the distinct impression that a number of people equate the category of tribal government or native government with that some kind of conjures up a notion of some kind of a primitive, offbeat, out of step kind of government that is unsuitable in the 20th century. I really believe that there are people who I hear speak that think that. Now, let me tell you what I do. I'm a business lawyer, is what I do. And it seems to me that the tribal governments in, gosh, I can't even hardly say that word, the lower 48. It's hard for my southern accent to say that word even. Have, I think, tremendous opportunities to have as sophisticated a form of government with the creativity of tribal legislatures to create the width and breadth for the room of all the broad range of kinds of native peoples that there are. Now, there are traditional people who say they don't like corporations. I don't know whether they do or not. There are people who are obviously in the business of running corporations and occupying those corporations. Now, I see no difficulty, for instance, let me give you...
Well, let's start. Our ranks are a little thinned today, but...
any kind of legal mechanisms that...
come up with some solutions. Well, Mary Miller, I said you would be next. You might get that microphone from Ralph Johnson.
Oh. And maybe you can answer on that, but you are not loping along too much
on their future. But the Constitution, in our Eskimo way, nobody knocked him down. I trained my grandson and a Willie's son. I tried to train him with in our future, old age, Constitution way.
Why don't you come and sit at the table, sir? You're welcome. If you want to come and sit by Willie.
Willie, in old days medical aid, I practice him all the time. The doctors on that, they told me, Willie, you're going to kill him. I give him penicillin shot too much. Right now, I'm very happy about that. The old Constitution way, I'm not creeping anymore. Or our land, when I had a tough time, very tough time, when my dad died, I tried to raise my younger kids. Very tough time. I gotta tell you truth right now again. Well, let's work together. Work together. Well, let's work together. I don't know that man over there, but there we get right hand man over there. I get tough time once in a while. Our future Constitution in World War II, he called that Alaska Territory Guard. I worked with together William Egan. That's a good point. Right now on that, I've got to tell you the truth, everybody on that, young ones. Well, let's work together. Adam Jellyfoot Knopf, well, let's work together. I'm not good man anymore. I won't lie like this all the time. I like to work with Willie Casale and Sam George. I like to work with you together. Leon.
Well, thank you, sir. And I remember the hospitality you extended to us when Mr. Case and I were in Acciachuck, and I want to thank you again for that. Where was I? Mary Miller, you're
What I was going to say would have been a very good way to begin this day, because some of the frustrations I was feeling are starting to be addressed and set aside. What I was going to say was that the last hour of discussion yesterday left me very, very frustrated, because I feel like the last hour of yesterday, we really weren't doing justice to the real potential of tribal governments in Alaska. The closest thing we came to yesterday was the brief comments that about what we can accomplish through tribal legislation that Mr. Pipestem alluded to very briefly. The rest of the time, we tap danced around this entire topic. And I don't like to dance, much less tap dance. One thing that I was wishing, and again, some of the frustrations and concerns I was feeling very deeply yesterday at the end of the day are being addressed now. But one thing I was wishing was that was that all of the Alaska Native population could be sitting in this room with us, completely surrounding us, because I felt like there were a lot of words thrown back and forth. Sometimes, and most oftentimes, I think with good intention, but often without any conscious realization that you're talking about very real people here. I believe that we are finally speaking with some vision today. Where we lacked it yesterday, hopefully that we are going to continue to have vision in the words that we talk about today. Because I believe...
Those differences aren't nearly as great as the kinds of differences that exist among the native peoples here. I'm not talking about different tribes. I'm talking about individuals and their differences. That there's such a variety of human needs here, and that there has to be a corresponding variety of modes of trying to satisfy those needs. But that means it's very messy and very complicated. And generally speaking, the temptation is to try to simplify, to unify, and to homogenize, to try to find the solution. Simply because it's so hard to keep so many variations in mind and to deal with them in any effective way. But although there is this kind of necessity because we're so incapable of keeping a million different things in hand and dealing with them all, there's a possibility and indeed a likelihood that the categories, the cubbyholes in which we stuff people and problems, and try to reduce, you know, a vast number to a smaller number, a more manageable number, that those categories themselves become tyrannical, that they manage us. And accordingly, that the means that we adopt, the instruments, the tools, that we adopt as a result of those categories, in turn, begin dictating how we think and what we think, how we analyze. Now, let me give an example, which isn't meant to be personal, and that's addressed to any particular individual, but one sees it again and again. There's a real risk that the better you become in manipulating certain kinds of languages and certain kinds of tools, especially if I'm talking about alien modes of thought, alien institutions, that the more entangled one becomes in them, the thing that becomes useful to you, I'm speaking you now as though I'm addressing a native person, can carry you away. And what may begin as a game, so to speak, you know, I can use this to beat the other guy at his thing, that game can itself become an end in itself without one's being half aware of it. So if the end in view is how to best serve the interests of the people involved, and that has been said again and again, and if the end in view is securing the consent of those people, I think that carries certain implications for what one tries to do and how one goes about trying to do it. It sounds to me as though one would wish to have, wherever possible, modest means and gentle procedures that fit better with the variety of human types and that has more respect for their vulnerability. At any rate, that one shouldn't act in such a way that closes off the future of a very old and diverse people. Things that seem so important today may not seem so important later on. If you talk about people who've been around for thousands of years, you know, I mean, granted, to see 50 years into the future takes an immense act, and you know, and who knows what it'll be. But I'm more concerned about acting in ways that don't leave sufficient flexibility for that very old and diverse people to change its sense of what's important to us now, 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now. So I'm really talking about governance, and I'm going to be more specific in a minute. So in thinking about what governance is to use, sure,
something to do something about it. You're forgetting my point. We are asking for restoration to all the rights, privileges, and responsibilities which we as tribes have, not just to you and your government, but to our people and our government. Our tribal governments have been sorely damaged. I've been making this point. Why must you insist that there has to be state of Alaska jurisdiction over Alaska's natives? Paper conquest. I think our native people would feel a lot better if you would just go about it and declare war. Eventually, there'd be a war settlement, would there not? Maybe we'll end up another Japan, an economic giant as a result of the American guilt trip. The non-native can afford tunnel vision with regard to his life. He can afford to specialize. I am a lawyer. Forget the rest. Everything else is in place. My government is secure. My services are provided. It's a government of the people, by the lawyers, for the multinational corporations. And the sooner that you realize that, the sooner that you're going to be able to save yourself, much less save us. As I said, the survival of our native people is in the balance. Everybody's wondering why the United States is on the defensive, not just up here. What about Nicaragua? What about Iran? Why are they saying that they do not want the champions of freedom in their midst? If they're doing to them what they're doing to us, I wouldn't want them either. But they are blessed with one thing. They are not sucked up into the federal system against their will. They are at least viewed as being foreign countries. And in that, they have an advantage. We have come that close to being smothered out of existence. And I say that the native government is one of the last examples of what the federal government and its people have said that they are all about for the last 200 years. Government of the people, by the people, and most importantly, for the people. Genocide, conquest, how do you do that? You beat a government into submission, or you legislate them out of existence. It just so happens that the federal government thought they could do it with one law, ANCSA. You displace the government, you make the settlement terms to a state-chartered business corporation. Actually, you're doing it three, because then you hamper your people that are supposed to be doing this great good for us on the economic scene. ANCSA said that by going the corporation route, we'll help these poor, indigent, uneducated native people. We'll pull them out of their tribal government and put them in a foreign body and say, hey, you got an account.
It is not a credentialing process for radicals. It is a governing process of being a government. It is not some kind of a credentialing exercise, because you're speaking about the law that will carry your people into the future. You are talking about the law that will guarantee services to your people of major importance. Let me give you some examples. And I don't want to use any other terms than just a few of the things that I've heard here. Why does everybody worry about the afterborn issue? You have the present authority in the document that I saw for UNICLEAT to have a tribal membership role. Do any of you have tribal membership roles? I don't know. If the tribal membership role is the same as the role of people who are enrolled in the village and who are enrolled in the region, then why aren't they? It seems to me that there's a place to begin. On the land issue, how come you can't get some more? I mean, I don't understand why you aren't trying to get some more that is untainted by this other process. Or maybe there isn't any that isn't untainted. But if that provides categorical and legal problems, find some and obtain some more. And I hear people continue to restate the problem. And I don't want to be misunderstood on that, because I want you to know, and I'm going to express that to you, that I love you.
why I sat on an airplane for I don't know how long to get to this place. I'm going to sit on another one to get back. But I would say to you that one of the functions of government is to begin to translate rhetoric into specificity that comes out in the form of laws and services for your people, and a means to activate the moral imperative. And I'm going to tell you what I told my son one time, that there may be discrimination in the world. There may be people who do not appreciate Indian people. There may be people who actively do not appreciate Indian people. But rather than to make a way of life out of that and develop a reactionary and negative identity of do-nothingness, but wallow in it and be crippled by it, is something that we need not do. You need to be aware of that, but you need to move on. Move on. There are future issues to be addressed here that only the native people are going to be able to address. Your advisors are going to be important to you. But I would just say to you that some of these things that I hear, and the question was asked, how do we dignify and legitimize tribal government? And the answer to that is simple. Know what it is and exercise its authorities. That is the beauty of what was left here for you as a people. It is something that is uniquely a part of you, that has uniquely been a part of the law of the United States, that Indian tribes are people who have the power to make laws and to be governed by them. Thank you.
Thank you, Brownie. Well, thank you, Browning, and thank you all. This has been a good 4 days. I've learned a great deal. Albert Einstein once said that man can only flourish in a community, and I suppose what we've been talking about is how is that community to be defined, and once defined, how is that community to govern itself? Well, thank you all again, and I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and I'll see you in
95. Starts its work again next year.
No.
I will.
I hope you have a nice Christmas.
Well, you too. And say that to your Meg, too.
I
will.
You don't
happen to know if James has been working on those papers?
I know he has. I told him that they had to be done, but I know he hasn't because I started on the I started these by myself and got them done, and then I started by myself. Still doing
that. Okay, well, is there
at the
any
point Hope ones are done.
Oh, good.
There was a big mistake. I need to talk to Ty.
Renita, I didn't get your tape read. I'll try and make it tonight.
I don't know. Are you sitting here now?
Yeah, I've been staying in Anchorage forever. So I think I'm going to go home.
Thank you. say that'll help.
But I'll tell him again, because he's got to get them done. I got the point hold once, and I need to talk with Don about it, because there's some, there were some pages that were missing. And so I included them, and the way that I did some translations, revisions, I also included in there.
Okay.
Barrows is going to be even tougher, because the way that we translated was not word for word, and a lot of the content was lost.
Well, I only sent, the only thing I sent James was just the overlaps to the tapes.
See later.
That I needed translated. Okay.
Don.
Great. You want something, huh?
Lucky man.
Thank you.
Eileen, before you go, as I can.
Huh?
To have a happy new year. That past year has been incredible. I was saying for a long time, our only problem was little Christie's dad, but we signed a visitation agreement with him. We got everything else we wanted, and he split for India for 3 months, so we're just overjoyed. Our only problem disappeared.
Nice.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to see that. I can't.